Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 3 of episode 41, where we are discussing Gareth Morgan's Images of Organization. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is our final installment of the episodes on Gareth Morgan's Images of Organization. And the central message of the book is really in the first chapter and the last chapter. And it's about how important all the metaphors are that are underlie theories that people use. And that if you just focus on one theory or metaphor, you're missing the richness of organizations. And Morgan takes us through those different metaphors and breaks them down and into how they were developed and how they're used, and gives a much deeper understanding of organizations through the 8 metaphors that are examined. And in this part of the podcast, we're going to talk a bit about the lessons of the text for us and where we see this going, how it could be used, and the big picture items that we thought were most interesting or impactful from a reflective reading of the text.
So the central message, as you mentioned, Ralph, seems very much to be this idea of using multiple metaphors as augmenting our capacity, both as analysts and as practitioners within organizations. And I think it's something that, you know, it's a broad claim that most people could get behind. The idea of, you know, you need different tools in your toolbox in order to act and understand organizational reality. But the problem becomes that usually these different perspectives can be incommensurable sometimes. And that's a long discussion that has happened in the social sciences about the incommensurability of paradigms. And in a way, it ties back to the very work by Morgan in his book Sociological Paradigms and Organizational Analysis with Gibson Burrell, that after it was published, there was a whole discussion to what extent different paradigms can be brought together. So we can ask the same question here. And one could argue, maybe using a more domination perspective or power perspective, that these different metaphors are not just, you know, semantic ways of understanding, but also they are linked to particular schools of thought and academics and, in a certain way, careers, academic careers. So there are politics at play in the construction of knowledge in which, you know, different perspectives and stance are going to try to push for what they think is the most appropriate way to make sense of certain issues and dynamics. But at the same time, you know, in a higher note, it's interesting that in the past decade at least, there has been a very strong development within the idea of paradoxes and this idea of trying to theorize not by eradicating paradox from theories and our own understanding of organizations, but trying to capture that and kind of, you know, leverage, because there is, I think, a growing understanding of trying to deal with what Morgan will be considered complex systems and more chaotic perspectives, and in which not only say, oh, this exists, but this exists and also this, and in a way we have to try to make sense of how these contradictions and paradoxes are maintained. So I think it's an interesting point that we can reflect upon, on to what extent there can be different alternatives when we know there are always politics vis-a-vis the issue that it seems the organizational theory is becoming more aware of the paradoxical nature of its own project.
Well, and that's a really good idea. I love the path you were going down and explored right there about the incommensurability of the metaphors, because you do feel like, and Morgan touches on that, but you do feel like there's this problem where, well, if you see the machine metaphor is really powerful, then how do you reconcile that with the organism one? Or do you tend to keep one exclusively over the other? So I think there's some overlaps, but there's quite a bit of distinctiveness in the first 4 metaphors: the organism, you know, machine and brain and control of the point is that it doesn't look like there's a lot of overlap. And then, as Ella was pointing out later, when you start looking at the forces kind of within organizations, then you start seeing the paradoxes kind of within the metaphors. And I think that's really an important point, is that it's probably more effective to see them as not one or the other dominating, right? That there's this kind of push and pull that goes back and forth. I mean, that was really something that opened my eyes when he was talking about that, because at first I was just not necessarily getting a loss, but it was kind of dismaying to think like, what's going on here? And then realizing, no, it's in the essence, it is the power is in the push and pull, not who wins per se, but these paradoxes and how you kind of go back and forth. That's why I love paradox research, because they look at, it's that the key insight is actually the paradox itself, not the actual idea or which idea triumphs. That's what I like about paradox research.
When we're trying to understand what's going on in organizations, this idea of competing paradigms, of conflicting metaphors, is really useful, because even though science is very concerned with this idea of commensurability and making sure that we're very clear about our boundaries around our knowledge, in practice, you've got all these people working together who all have a particular understanding of the world that they're working in and organizing in. And sometimes they're not compatible. I've seen just use metaphors talking about the workers as worker bees. You know, they've got this sense of the hive, or they've been talking about how their employees are like animals who will compete for scarce resources. And then you've got others in the organization understanding their organization as a network, where others are very concerned with the building. And you've got all these people working together with these very different root assumptions about what an organization is, and yet they're acting in sometimes very conflicting ways based on those assumptions. Morgan's point becomes really interesting, that we don't just use metaphors to read a situation. So he talks about we use a metaphor as a lens to read what's going on, but we're also authoring that situation. So this is about the performativity of metaphors. So we don't just see with them, we're actually acting and enacting realities based on them. It's a powerful way to understand some of the complexities we see in organizations when you consider that people are enacting different versions of this organization at once, and that leads to certain conflicts.
Yeah, and I love that idea about enactment, both Wyke's writings on that, but also as Morgan talks about it and it applies to organizations. And I think Ella's something that's really important there, this idea that multiple people in the organizations are enacting, you know, what they see and what they has, you know, important. So yes, of course you have conflict, but this idea is, you know, step back from the conflict and you gain this insight that there's this enactment going where people are, you're taking their assumptions and living those assumptions and acting them out in the various things they do. And of course that leads to conflict and or conflicting information and things that confuse the workers. Is, you know, I've been in many organizations where you just say, well, this one person's saying this, the other person's saying that, you know, and I got to work for both. How do I reconcile those kinds of things? Because I've been in matrix organizations, but I've also been in organizations where in my position, I reported to three or four different senior people. And, you know, one of them would write my performance evaluation, but these others, I really had to have their cooperation, and I needed them to mobilize their teams. And that was very difficult, kind of resolving those different roles, because every now and then they would point in different directions or you know, ask me to do something that wasn't legal. And I'm not talking about robbing a bank or anything, but basically somebody wanted me to change some aspect of the contract. And I said, it's not, I can't do that because the contract's still being negotiated. And you're asking for something that only, I can only spend this kind of money once the negotiations are complete. And the person who was giving me that direction, I mean, their response was that I was near insubordinate for saying that. And it was really, you know, difficult to resolve those different enactments of the situation in this large organization, because this was a situation where multiple organizations were coming together and had, like, you know, a larger project kind of aspect, you know, to it. So that thing makes things very difficult.
So not only people themselves have different perspectives and they might be operating through different metaphors, but different parts of the organization or even an organization itself.
Absolutely.
Might bring different perspective. You know, I just have a quick note that it's interesting that, so it seems that we are hinting at the point that reality is complex. So we need to leverage that complexity, not try to attempt to simplify, ignore it. You know, Haritsuka has an interesting paper that's exactly about that. That is about complexifying, not just trying to simplify, which is usually what, as you said, Ella, theory tries to do, but, you know, we miss the richness and the reality of, you know, organizations.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice point. So this applies both to the practice of management and to the practice of studying management, of creating theory around management that complexifying is sometimes, although it can be a bit counterintuitive, sometimes the better thing to be doing.
Yeah, I agree with you, because if you, like Morgan says with the metaphors, right, if you just pick one, you're leaving out a whole bunch of stuff, right? So that, you know, that happens when you simplify things. So if you take, you take things and reduce them to the standard, you know, social science 2x2 matrix, okay, yeah, that gives you some insight. But that, I don't know if that always works in your, in your direction, in the direction of goodness or better understanding. Because like Ella was saying, maybe it's actually, the complexity is something to be embraced. I mean, that's certainly something that you see in complexity science research, is that the a lot of the value comes from embracing that complexity and the chaos and the different kinds of attractors. It's just, I think for a lot of people, at least from my experience of meeting people in organizations, that could be unsettling. You know, it's not.
Morgan does point out, though, that it might be tempting to think that he's suggesting that we go through each of these metaphors every time we're facing a situation where we need to decide what to do. And he said, that's going to be overwhelming. Don't do that. Don't try and mechanize this, but try and use it as a toolkit, as was suggested earlier and has also been suggested by Vike.
Yeah, and he gives some good examples. Right. He gives those two examples in chapter 12. And what I really liked about the example was he did it twice, right? So he has the case study description, and then he shows the reading of the organization twice and using some of the different metaphors. And I thought that was really interesting, because it's this really two or multiple ways to look at it, depending on whether you want to, you know, diagnose the problems or you want to change something or do something differently. And I think a lot of that drives, and Morgan's very clear about, a lot of that drives what metaphors you choose to use, because it's, you really can't disconnect that from your purposes, right? So if you're all about controlling and changing the organization, then you're going to use different metaphors than if you're trying to understand it or support creativity and imagination. And Morgan says that's okay. In fact, I was just thinking of, you know, where the book itself is a metaphor, in that organizations can be read, right? So whether it's a book or something to be described, you know, that's the overall metaphor of the book. So there is definitely the metaphor within the metaphors there.
I was thinking about those things within the political economy of academia. And it's interesting that many people have almost like a very hot topic nowadays is the whole idea of, you know, interdisciplinary research and becoming more interdisciplinary. But in a way, we don't even do a lot of just, how can I call it, cross-theoretical, cross-perspective kind of things, because we usually have our own approaches we can call metaphors, and don't even necessarily know dialogue with other people that might see the same perspective from different lenses or perspectives or methods and concepts. It's funny that, you know, we to talk about the whole big step of bringing disciplines together, even within disciplines itself, it's difficult for a number of reasons to just, you know, be aware and apply all the different tools that you can for that particular situation.
There's not much incentive sometimes, and it takes so much effort to understand one perspective, one way of looking. And you need to, of course, be across all that literature. So to then step out of your own comfort zone and into another perspective, it takes a lot of work. But there is some work around this. So again, Alverson has a book on called Reflexive Methodology, where this is encouraged. So you actually are encouraged to take different perspectives on the same theoretical problem or same empirical problem, sorry.
Well, and so that's a great point. What I think helps me is kind of sort of get out of my paradigm or metaphors is when I go to conferences and I look at some of those things that are being presented, you know, when I'm not presenting, and the different perspectives or metaphors that the authors are using. So I'll give you an example. I went to the OLKC last year, and I went to a session about organized forgetting. Because, you know, usually you think about, okay, we're going to just change and we're going to do some new thing. And the people in this session, there were, I think, 3 or 4 papers being presented, and they were talking about the challenge of the organizational forgetting, you know, what organizational forgetting is, and the fact that you it's probably incomplete to look at the change metaphor as, I just want you to stop what you're doing and do something else. You actually have to think about what that transition would be. And until I'd gone to that session, I never really thought of it that way. But then I thought, oh, that really is important way to go look at it. So I find conferences very useful to help me get out of my metaphor and try to get in some other ones, particularly when it's something I say, I don't even know what they're doing in there. So maybe I'll go in and talk to them. And often the presentation and the conversation brings all sorts of interesting different metaphors to light.
Can I ask an unsettling question?
Oh, please do.
So what is an organization? And the reason why I ask that is because as I listen to all of the discussion in this particular part, it brings me back to this idea about, you know, the book is focused on images of organization. And a lot of what we've talked about in terms of how we define the organization and define the boundary of the organization, membership within it, interaction with the environment, is from the perspective of an organization. And there's in the example of the academic communities, you've got the organization that you formally belong to, and then you have the community of scholars whose basically your perspectives, who you're working with, who you're sharing, who you're researching with, who you're publishing to. So when you take the perspective of the member, of the individual, who's actually a member, a formal member of a whole wide range of organizations, you know, the one that they work for, the one that they, the familial bonds, the community in which they live, all of these, you know, their networks, their social networks or what have you. There's all of these organizations in which the individual is in. And a lot of the metaphors that we're talking about, that we're using, define the boundary of the organization different ways. The machine metaphor, it's a very, very thick boundary. I mean, you know, you are a part of this machine. You're a cog in the machine. You are nothing else. You know, when we're talking about, you know, how do we use these metaphors, or how do we consult with managers and do all that sort of thing? You know, part of this, I think, comes down to how is the what kind of an organization is it in the first place? And just how porous is that boundary? Because I think, like, for example, within military organizations in particular, we have like multiple spheres of influence which we're concerned with. There's the formal organization, which is the commander and the troops in front of him or her. There is then this wider area of interest that involves, say, the families in which the leader is chartered with, essentially taken care of, especially in deployments and that sort of thing. Yeah. So so when I think about, say, the U.S. military and what its areas of interest are, it includes families who are not part of the formal organization, but whose membership, if you will, is vital to the functioning and the readiness of the military organization. And there's contractors. There's an industrial base in which, say, a military relies upon to be able to tap in to get supplies, resources, or what have you. What I'm trying to think of is that maybe as like a companion idea to this particular book, there's almost like a similar metaphors of membership that would be kind of interesting to compare the degree to which my commitment to an organization is rock solid. Say, I am 100%, you know, I am a part of this particular formal organization, but I also, you know, kind of bringing in identity theory, the salience is high for this link, but my salience for, say, being part of my community of scholars or what have you is even more salient, and I'm trading off between the two. When I'm at work, I'm in this organizational setting and I'm part of this organization. When I'm off work, I am not part of that organization whatsoever. I'm in this particular setting. And the reason why I bring that up is because, I mean, when we talk about, say, talking with leaders about, you know, how do you want to make the organization more effective, more efficient, trying to help them along and think about the ways in which they want to communicate that, it's good to talk about or to provide them some vocabulary that they can use, which is simple. But if it doesn't account for the perspective of all of the members, I mean, I can see where the tension between what we're telling the leader to do and the perspective of the members can be in just, you know, they can be in constant conflict, especially if it's an organization where you have an issue with member commitment to the organization, where the members feel like the leaders are not listening to us, they don't trust us, or what have you.
Oh, Nia, you're even making me think of newer organizational forms. We've mentioned the gig economy a few times, but I'm fascinated in how this is playing out in, for example, the Uber scenario, where they're not technically employees. And at least in Australia, I was getting in cars which I had booked through Uber, but I would see that they had different screens on the dashboard where they were opening different apps that were all different ride-sharing services and would just flick between them depending on where they could get a better ride. So for the drivers, then, what does that mean in terms of membership? What's their organization? They're within an instant flitting between these different platforms. It makes this story very complex.
Well, and I love that metaphor of membership. I think that's really powerful, Tom, because it kind of transcends these other aspects of organizational science. And you gave a great illustration there, Ella, about, well, is an Uber driver really a member of the organization when they're really just kind of going back and forth between whichever organization offers them a better deal or a situation or the ride's closer or, you know, whatever their that rationality is that they're using at the time. And when Tom was talking about the kind of multiple levels of membership, I was thinking about an analog for academics, and that is this peer review that you do, where you owe this, you know, have this duty to the community, which is very real work, right? People say, well, you don't get compensated for it, but you must do it, or it's part of your membership in the organization of scholars to which you participate, which is not the same thing as what your local organization is or the university, and yet it's still important work. And then Tom was talking about, well, and if you're a leader, let's say you're an editor of a magazine, journal, or you're of an academic organization of scholars, how do you motivate people when, you know, is it just, you know, duty to community, or, you know, here's how things get better? And so I see a lot of those threads going on. Some of it's flux and some of it's change management. I don't see a whole lot of power. There's also the power dominance of the various schools of thought and paradigms of the peer review. I mean, because so peer review's got these great aspects, but it's also got that dark side where if you're trying to do something that's different than the prevailing paradigm, you can get completely squished.
We are getting close to the issue that, you know, we could pretty much rethink the book or think of another book even from a different perspective, which would be from the perspective of the individual and more specifically of the worker. And again, we mentioned that, I think, in the past parts is exactly this thing that we felt that was missing is the idea of work. And, you know, and Tom brought the idea of the membership, but it's intertwined. You know, when you do a certain task, when you're a part of a kind of professional, occupational, whatever, in the case of, you know, academics, or you are engaged in a particular kind of work, so to speak, real work, in the case of the gig economy, the drivers, that already, it's a different way into the overall dynamics of organizational analysis.
Yeah, and one of the things that kind of spurred me this is, you know, I live not too far away from Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is the home of the Hershey, you know, the Hershey Chocolate Company. And it's a very famous place where Milton Hershey, who was the original founder and owner, one of his hallmarks was the degree to which he cared or provided for all aspects of life for the employees. And so what we had was that, the employees not only were provided employment, but they were also provided a place to live. They had entertainment. They had all of these aspects were essentially provided as under the company umbrella. And then we compare that to, say, the gig economy nowadays, where it's the complete and total opposite. I mean, basically the organization's commitment to the individual is limited to the pure economic transactions. Everything else is left to the individual. And we talked about that. I forget which episode that was, but it was a very recent episode where we talked about some of the challenges that that presents. If I'm the individual, of course, I have all of these needs. I have basic needs for, the food, the clothing, the shelter, and et cetera, care, feeding. And so, you know, in the one sense, we can kind of perhaps discuss how the care, basically, where does the individual get all of those, or get that care and feeding? What's is provided for by, say, the organizations in which the individual belongs versus what is left to the individual to self-sustain. And that seems to be like a you know, a big difference between the way, you know, membership in among the various organizations, which, you know, an individual could be working for or being part of, you know, that's a point of difference.
Yeah, I think that's it's a great point, because the where does that leave? You know, we were talking about the maybe there's a need for the individual level analysis or metaphors and where that fits in. So where does that leave the individual when the entire connection to the organization is purely transactional? You know, it's purely financial. That I think there's a lot of talk in the gig economy where this is great, you know, and you're sharing these resources or making use of these resources. And sure, there's that aspect to it, but I sometimes, you know, when Tom was talking about that, I was thinking there's an aspect of the gig economy that's practically soulless. So, you know, without soul or without kind of meaning. And that it makes me think of the paradigm that Bowman and Deal discuss, the symbolic frame, right? Where this kind of idea, like, where do you fit in and what do these symbols mean? So in the gig economy, that's pretty much out the window. And it's all about, well, I have this flexibility to kind of work whenever you want. And you wonder, is that enough? You know, so I think that kind of, I'd love to see research on the workers in the gig economy, you know, particularly, you know, Deliveroo or Uber or Lyft, where you look at what's it like for them.
So in the symposium we organized, you know, last December, we had a colleague from the Oxford Internet Institute, Gretchen Corporal, and she was actually hinting on the fact that for some people, especially for the more maybe high-end, we might call it that way, work through online platforms, non-location-specific kind of gig work. It's not even gig work. But there is a sense of attachment, and I was just mentioning that because, you know, there is a famous book that we have not discussed yet, but we might in the future, called The Organizational Man by William White, that was published in the 50s, that looks exactly that, takes more all the discussions on bureaucracy and machine that we have been having and we had in the podcast in the past, and look through those things through the eyes of the membership, of the worker, of the person, you know. And the interesting fact that I suspect that today in the gig economy or the changing nature of work today in general, we might still have different people according to maybe the geography, the work, the socioeconomic situation, whatever it is, we don't know the variables, that might still have some kind of affiliation despite the changing nature of the affiliation that they have, the membership that they have. Or not. So there is still this to be discovered and research kind of theme. And since I talked about, you know, possible future episodes, we actually might have one in the next season about exactly that, organizational boundaries and the whole issue that you were hitting at, Tom. The idea of, you know, where it stands, especially nowadays with the changing nature of the economy.
Well, I think that's worth exploring because there's that extra dimension it brings to work. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about when you were describing that, Pedro, the work that Gritja has done in the gig economy, was that there's whole other level of analysis that we may be missing that I think it would be worth doing future research on. I mean, Morgan had to pick, you know, he had to pick some metaphors and throw some out, you know, not really use them. So of course he had to be selective about what he chose. And I certainly think one of the things that we're coalescing around is that, you know, we see sort of this individual level lacking or something that we would like to see explored more further in either another research or, you know, if he was going to write another book or if we were going to write a book. And I also like the fact that I interviewed Matt Salveson for the podcast that we did or the episode we did. And I just love the way he writes and the way he has this very, very contrarian and critical view of organizations that help you think differently about them, right? And that's actually why I think some of this research is that we've been discussing is helpful to kind of give you these other ways. I mean, maybe it's not a new metaphor, but to look at different things going on. I mean, and Ella was talking about that in episode 2 about, you know, you're looking at the flux that's going on, and so it's a different perspective as opposed to, you know, how the organization should be run. It's about what's going on internally, which I thought was a really good way to look at it. I hadn't thought of it that way until she said it. And then I thought, oh yeah, there's these sort of things at the micro level. And then, and you could either get dismayed because it doesn't fit your control metaphor, or you can say, no, I should embrace the fact that I can't control all of this stuff. And maybe that's okay. And maybe I'll focus on the stuff I can or the things I can influence. And these other things, not, you don't ignore them, but you know that they're going on. And maybe, you know, one approach for managers is to talk to people and find out, you know, what's going on in the flux and what are they seeing. And I was actually pretty amazed in my organizational life when I was working in different organizations, how seldom that was done, you know, just to find out what, you know, what people think about what's going on.
So for anyone out there, we have an idea for a new book, Images of Organized Work.
Yes, that's exactly. So, you know, we can collaborate on that. So I think we've looked at the text in a couple of different perspectives. So the text alone, you know, what we wish had been in there, what might be in there, what could be in another edition, how it connects to research. So now what I'd like to ask each of you to do is tell me what your takeaways are, the things that struck you about the work, or, you know, what you think about how you think it might influence the research that you do.
So I think my main takeaway might be a bit funny, but it's actually that I'm thankful for this book and overall work by Morgan that somehow helped to create this field and perspective, which we call organizational analysis. In a way, the book's very instrumental to all that in providing legitimacy to this way of doing research and kind of themes. Because you think about it, there is the main core idea of looking not only at managers and management, but also how organizations are worked out and how they function as important to this, you know, way that you can operate in them and you can manage them. There's also the issue of, although we talked about individual perspective, we can't talk about this now because we first created an awareness that organizations are emergent phenomena and they require kind of specific research and theories to be understood. And there's this insistence on metaphors, which ties in the overall idea of interpretation and more interpretive research. So all these kind of elements, interpretive research, looking at organizational order and looking at organization, not only managers, is pretty much what defines for me my own analytical work, part of the overall field of management and organizational scholarship. And this book has pushed it not only within scholarly circles, but actually for practitioners, for managers, for the overall audiences, because it has been such popular across different places. So I think my overall takeaway is the importance of this work in creating space for the kind of ideas we have been discussing so far.
Okay. I'm going to piggyback on what Pedro said, because one of the things that just astonishes me about this book is just how broad the scope of the literature that he covered and was still able to integrate it into a fairly, you know, a single cohesive thread, a discussion of metaphors it's an extremely long book and it covers an incredible amount of territory, but being able to, you know, devote the time to actually read it from start to finish is just amazing of how much he synthesized and came out on the back end with a good storyline and something that, a tool that is really, really useful. And of course, you know, we're talking about all of the things that we would like to see added to it that, I almost have to smile when I say that. I say, how do you add something to a book that's already so big? But it's, so really kudos for doing that. My other takeaway is, because my focus is on strategic communication. And so the primary lens which I look through is, all right, what am I going to tell leaders for them to be able to communicate vision to their organizations, to be able to communicate the need for change, to be able to communicate or to work on improving organizations' performance? And the metaphors really... I see them in use and I have used them myself, and I offer to them that, perhaps if one metaphor doesn't work, here's another one to use or something like that. This book really expanded that toolkit, obviously. But it also gave me a chance to really critically think about those metaphors into the real utility, because as I said before, it's one thing to use them as a bumper sticker to try to bring about change or to offer a message that something has to change within an organization. But if it isn't backed up by an associated change of behavior, then they're precisely that, bumper stickers. And that's obviously a pitfall, because anytime that you just have a PowerPoint deep, then it's not going to work and it's going to breed cynicism towards change among the organization. So this book helped me in that regard to think through in much more depth the metaphors that I'm going to be assisting others in using for bringing about change.
Yeah, I really agree, Neo. I think that there's a lot to learn here. And in my own teaching, I would like to draw on this book more in asking students and managers to really surface their own assumptions around what kind of images come to mind when they think of what is an organization. If you can get a sense of which kind of image or which metaphor is underpinning that person's work, then you can get a better sense of what their priorities are and what their goals are and what they're seeing and perhaps what they're not seeing. So I think it's a good way to guide understanding as a way of critically interpreting.
Well, the challenge of going last in these views is that you all had such great insights. It's hard for me to come up with something that you haven't already done. So I think I'll have to rethink which order I go next time. But because I agree with all of your perspectives, and I think those are all very good points you make. So in the interest of bringing up something different, I was struck by the sentence in there he has, or the expression, that a way of seeing is a way of not seeing. So this idea like Ella was talking about, these assumptions, trying to understand what it is they're not seeing, right? And what is it in my own research that because of the metaphors or the assumptions that I'm not questioning, what am I not seeing about what's going on? I thought that was very powerful. And it's going to stick with me. If I recommend it, or when I recommend to other people this idea that how that it opens your eyes to these other things that are going on. I really thought that was a powerful feature of reading the book. And for our listeners, yes, it's a long book. I get all that. But if you really can't get all the way through it, or you just don't have enough time because you're busy with all your classes, you can get the essence of it in the introduction, which is chapter 1, and in the postscript in chapter 12. That'll give you the essence of what you're talking about. And of course, then you also listen to our podcast, and that'll help you too. Now, the second thing I got, because all of you had more than one thing, so I want to try to do a second one. And that was, and this really came home for me in the conversation that we've been having, and it was particularly Ella when she was talking about, she helped me see the flux that's discussed in the change chapter, right? We have all these things kind of going on, and I saw these things going on and change. But when she used that word, and in engineering, and physics, things I've studied in the past, you know, flux is very important. And that word really kind of opened my thinking up to, yeah, it's that dynamic of how things are going on and what's being passed and forth. And Ella talked about communications and, you know, what that really means. And so that was very powerful to me, this idea that there's these things that go back and forth, and, you know, people adjust them and mold them and transmit them in different ways, and all communication has some kind of motivational center to it. And I think that was a very powerful part of the book, because I really wasn't, a lot of the things, as Pedro had said earlier, we've covered a lot of this stuff, and it's got this broad scope, as Tom said. And I just think, oh yeah, sort of at that micro detailed level, get all these ideas and interests kind of whizzing around in organizations, and that's okay. You know, and you're not going to control them, and it's probably not realistic to think you ever could or even should in organizations, but they're still going on. And maybe there's some leverage there for managers, and maybe there's interesting things for researchers to study, but that had a big impact on me. And that's all for part 3 of episode 41. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.